WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Serial killers and serial rapists tend to be the most bewildering, personally disturbing, and most difficult to catch of all violent criminals, according to my guest John Douglas. He's the former head of the FBI's Serial Crime Unit. He retired from the FBI in June and now has a new bestseller about his work called Mindhunter. Douglas was the model for the FBI agent Jack Crawford in the novel and film Silence of the Lambs. Douglas worked on such cases as the Atlanta child murders, the Tylenol murders, and the Son of Sam. He's interviewed over 150 convicted killers, including Charles Manson, Richard Speck, and Gary Heidnik. By profiling convicted serial killers, he learned that they often leave clues at the scene of the crime that reflect their personalities. Douglas used this information to develop a new approach to tracking down serial killers. He looks for what he describes as the killer's signature.
A signature is that unique aspect about the crime, really something that you should look at when you link cases together. For example, I've testified in cases where the signature was posing. After the killer killed his victims, he would pose the victims in various positions. In another case, I was involved with the common denominator, the signature, was torture. He would torture his victims. Even though the torturing was different in each one of the cases, the common thread was torture. So I would testify, not that the defendant sitting over there is responsible, but for whoever committed these crimes, perpetrated all of these crimes because the common thread was torture, posing, or whatever.
Now, you developed your technique for profiling serial killers and tracking them down by interviewing serial killers and serial rapists in California prisons and studying them, getting to know them. Let's look at one of the people who you interviewed and some of the things you learned by talking with him that seemed to be fairly typical of other serial killers as well. Mm-hmm. I was thinking we could look at Ed Kemper.
Okay.
And now, who is he?
Ed Kemper was extremely bright, 145 IQ. He was 6'9". He weighed 300 pounds. When he was 14 years old, he killed his grandparents and called his mom up and told mom, hey, guess what? I killed grandma and grandpa, and I won't be going back next summer visiting them. And so they arrested, of course, Ed Kemper, but they put him in a mental institution, and then they released him at about 18 to 19 years of age. They put him back into society, and I sarcastically will say they cured him. Well, they didn't cure him. He was the victim of a severe amount of child abuse and neglect at the hands of his mother, so they put him back in the custody of his mother. And he was what I would call asexual, asocial. He would have wanted to date, and his mother, who worked at a university, said, hey, listen, you're nothing but a bum. No matter what you do or grow up to be, you'll never be able to date these girls. So in his mind, he said, well, I'm gonna show her. So he would pick up hitchhikers around the campus. He had a university sticker on his car, so the girls, these unsuspecting hitchhikers, felt safe. He would get either one or two girls in the car. It didn't make any difference because he already rigged the door handle when they got into the vehicle. They were unable to open the door once they realized that they were going not in the place where they wanted to go. He then took them out, would kill them, would decapitate them, cut their hands off to delay identification, but then would take the heads back to his house, bury the heads outside of his mother's window, and just would fantasize and about at times even having sex with these girls, although he had no sex with them, but really was trying to get back at and was getting back at mom. The case ended finally after killing seven co-eds. He killed his mother, decapitated her, and put her head on a kitchen table, and basically was kind of chewing her out for the ill treatment that he received throughout his childhood. He then fled, was arrested in Colorado. I think what I learned from an individual like this, it just kind of reinforced the fact that most of the offenders who I interviewed have all come from these dysfunctional families, almost without exception. This is not to say if you come from a dysfunctional family, you're going to grow up to be a violent offender, but of the violent offenders who I've interviewed, they've all come from this particular background.
No, I think you also found out that when this guy was young, he'd torture animals.
Right, and that's what you come in, we call the homicidal triangle, which includes animal cruelty, arson, and enuresis, which is bedwetting. And the bedwetting continues up to 8, 10, 12 years of age. The animal cruelty begins right around kindergarten, 6, 7, 8 years of age. And arson usually starts at about that time. So when you're a parent or if you're a school teacher and you see these characteristics, the odds are very, very high that that this person is going to grow up to be a violent offender. In fact, I've always said that school teachers are probably some of your best profilers because they see these things, these traits, these characteristics very, very early on.
I guess it doesn't shock me that a serial killer would have tortured animals when he was young or started fires when he was young. The bedwetting, I don't really understand.
The bedwetting has to do more of an emotional problem and not a physiological problem with them. And it's from the abuse that they're receiving at the hands of the parents. And so it's really, it's an emotional element.
Now, what about Ed Kemper's sex fantasies? Because you say that there's often a connection between somebody's sex fantasies and mm-hmm. their signature when they become a serial killer.
His sex fantasy was really mutilation, decapitation. When he was locked in the cellar of his home, he couldn't live with the rest of the family. He would fantasize by cutting off the heads of his sister's dolls, beheading them. And at times he played with his sister. His sister would participate, and as if he was in the electric chair, and she was going to now, kill him, turn on the switch. But he had many morbid fantasies, to include this mutilation was the big thing with him, and so sex was not a driving element. Again, it was manipulation and domination and control again of the victims. It gave him this power, and I really don't believe either that had he come from a normal, loving, nurturing family that he would have grown up to be this serial killer. It all goes back to early childhood, and particularly the mother. The mother plays the most influential part in the development.
But, you've pointed out that the person who the serial killer is most angry at, the abusive parent, for instance, isn't the person who they attack.
No, it's kind of interesting. Rather than strike out at the person that they really despise, they go out on the hunt. And sometimes the person, it starts with the mother, but then now they're in a situation where they're married or have a girlfriend. There's a conflict in that relationship. But rather than go after them, they go out on the hunt looking for a victim, one who they can let out their anger and hostility towards. But then what they do is they take some type of memento, a trophy. It could be a piece of jewelry or a piece of clothing. And like the cat who comes back and drops the mouse on the doorstep, they go back to the wife, to the mother, girlfriend, and they present them with this piece of jewelry. And it's just kind of like a little game they're playing, but they usually want this significant woman in their life to wear this so that they can fantasize and relive the crime over and over in their mind.
As I mentioned, you learned a lot by studying serial killers, interviewing them in depth in prison. What was it like for you to go into prison and do a personality profile of somebody who, murdered or decapitated a bunch of people? Yeah. I mean, it's not like the kind of interviewing I do.
No, and it takes its toll on you. And many of the people that work for me have difficulty doing this. And the thing you have to do when you do the interview is you have to do the research. You have to go in there armed with materials regarding the crime. You must look at the crime scene photographs. You must look, if it's a rapist, look at that rapist style, that verbal, the sexual, the physical assault that he inflicted on this victim. So you must listen, you do the interview, you listen to them, and then after 4 or 5 hours, then you got to go after them and then say, look, I know you're BSing me here. You're trying to pull the wool over my eyes. I don't really care about that you killed these victims. I do really care, but I can't let him know this. And I'll say what I really are interested. I'm interested in is how you were able to elude the police for so long. And then I may start telling the killer, if it's a killer I'm talking to, things about himself. For example, I'll say, I know there was a precipitating event leading up to these crimes that pushed you over the top. And I knew there were certain things, you know, going on in your life that you know, that people aren't aware of. But let me tell you about yourself, and then I'll go in and I'll start analyzing the crime. And I may say, in this one case that I talk about, a guy named Charlie Davis, I said, Charlie, I said, I know you didn't like this this particular kill. And so how do you know that? I says, because after you killed her, you turned her over, you pushed her away from you, and you covered her body up. And I said, what is it, Charlie? What didn't you like about that? And he looks at me, and he got all red, all flushed, and he said, well, when I was, after I raped her, and I knew I had to kill her, she started to beg for life, and she told me that her husband was sick, and she had psychological problems, emotional problems of various types, I felt something towards this victim that I did not want to kill her. So that's why I turned her over, and in fact, I strangled her from the back. I didn't want to look in her eyes. But then I said, now you took something from her, Charlie, didn't you? And I don't ask the question, did you take something, Charlie? I said, I'm very positive because I know the personality. I said, you took something, didn't you? And then what happens is he went into this trance-like state, and he said, I looked in her purse, and in her purse I found a photograph, and the photograph was a picture of her husband and her and her dog sitting before a Christmas tree. And then I said, you did something with that photograph, didn't you, Charlie? What was it? And he kind of looked, I have him back at the scene now. I said, you went to the gravesite, didn't you, Charlie? And he looks at me and he says, yes. What did you do? And he said, I know he's not lying to me because I could just see the verbals and I could just see his nonverbal communication and he's flushed. He said, I put that photograph at that grave. I buried it just a few inches below the soil. So you really learn. But to do what I do, you have to walk in the shoes of the killer, walk in the shoes of the victim. But it takes an emotional toll. It took an emotional toll on me. And as a result of the toll it took on me, it affected my family, my children.
Yeah, I want to get to that emotional toll a little bit later. Well, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk more about your work with the FBI. My guest is John Douglas. He's the author of the new book, co-author of the new book, Mindhunter. And he's a pioneer of criminal personality profiling within the FBI, where he specialized in tracking down serial killers. He recently retired from the FBI. This is Fresh Air. Back with John Douglas, co-author of the book Mindhunter, about his career in the FBI, profiling and tracking down serial killers. You've interviewed so many serial killers. Have you found that they ever have any remorse or any sense of what it is they've actually done?
No, they'll fake it, and I'll go along with it. You'll see tears streaming down their face, but the tears are for themselves, that their life is ruined. They could care less about the victims and the families, the lives that they've ruined, but they cry for themselves, and they'll cry post-arrest, or they'll cry when you interview them in jail. But there's nothing, in fact, if you would polygraph them after the crime, that's why they're very difficult to show deception, because they feel the crimes they committed are justified. So there's nothing there.
Now, would you call the typical serial killer insane?
No. A typical serial killer has a character disorder. He knows right from wrong. I mean, he's not normal, but he's not insane. He's in touch with reality. But usually, again, it's after they've been briefed by the defense attorneys where they'll come up with defenses such as irresistible impulse as one. And what that is to give you an example, is if you are standing on a street corner, that the subject is across the street from you, his urges are so strong that he kind of even blacks out, that he must, if his thing is rape or abduction, he will go through with the rape and go through with the crime, follow it up. But I've never seen a case where there's been a woman on a street corner and a police officer on the other corner, and where the subject, through his irresistible impulse, could not control himself, could not contain himself, where he said, well, I better not do anything with this victim. It's a baloney. It's as far as a defense, this irresistible impulse. And so they come up with these defenses, is my point, after they've talked with the defense attorney, and they'll use that as a defense, or post-Vietnam syndrome when they didn't go to Vietnam, use a Twinkie defense, or hypoglycemia, multiple personality, like Bianchi, the Hillside Strangler, tried to use. And it's all a bunch of baloney. These people have a character disorder. They're psychopaths.
You describe serial killers as psychopaths. What does that mean to you? And was it? I've heard sociopath used a lot.
Yeah, it's basically the same thing. Sociopath or antisocial behavior. They're all. It's basically the same person who's has this character disorder, does not have a conscience at all, and will show no remorse for their crimes. If you could compare them to an animal, or I would compare them to a chameleon. They can blend into their environment, be very nice, very, very charming. They can get some unsuspecting victim, out of a bar at night, or get a child out of a shopping center in broad daylight, and just scoop that child away from his parents.
One of the things you did at the FBI was to create a style of interviewing serial killers or accused mm-hmm. serial killers. And tell the Bloody Rock story.
Oh, this was in Adairsville, Georgia. And where a young girl, Marie Stoner, was abducted after being dropped off on a school bus in front of her home. They found her body about 10, 11 miles away in a Lover's Lane area. Mary Stoner was only 14 years of age at the time. She would be killed by the use of a rock, about a 40-45 pound rock that was picked up by the offender and carried over to her while she was on the ground still, because he attempted to strangle her with his hands. He didn't have the strength enough to do it. So she was unconscious. So he drops this rock on her head several times, and killing Mary Stoner. So I did a profile of the offender, that this would be someone I felt that he would be in his mid to late 20s. There's a degree of sophistication. He's fairly organized. He was able to lure her into his car, because it would take a car to drive her to this particular location. He'll be in a menial occupation and probably even maybe working in that area during the last week or several weeks. You're going to find that he's had problems most very, very recently with a woman, could be married, separated, whatever. But then rather than strike out at her, he's going to go on the hunt and look for a potential victim of opportunity. But I said, this particular girl, it was very outgoing, low-risk victim, but every day she'd come home wearing this short skirt. So here you had an offender that was in the area looking at her, but his totally misinterpreting what he sees. He actually thinks that this girl is going to go willingly with him, have sex, and then go home to his house. And I said, he did not feel good about this homicide. I said, well, what do you mean by that? And I said, well, because check your records. I bet he strangled this girl from the back with her back turned to him. And they came back later and they said, yes, you're right. How do you know that? I said, because when he was raping this girl in the car, he did not expect what would happen next. And that's when you have to walk in the shoes of the victim. And what when you walk in her shoes, and what I attempted to do and try to feel was that she was under an extreme amount of pain. She was crying. She was sobbing. Please take me home. I do anything. But he knew now he lost control of the situation, so he had to kill her. And so then he picks up this rock and drops this rock on her head several times. So John, they said, you interviewed a guy. We've interviewed a guy now, but you're describing him to a T. We just released him. We have him scheduled for the polygraph today. I said, hey, go ahead, but you're going to get no deception or inconclusive. They call me back up and they say, John, you're right. We got inconclusive at best, and it appears to be no deception. But he fits this profile. I said, okay, let's do a nighttime interview. And we're going to bring the rock, introduce the rock into the interview environment. I want a nighttime interview because I want him, on one hand, to feel comfortable in this environment, but I want to create stress, and the stress will be the murder weapon. If, in fact, he is the killer, he will respond to that murder weapon. But place the murder weapon on a 45-degree angle off in the corner of the room, and bring him in just for a routine type of questioning again.
So when you put the rock in the room, the bloody mm-hmm. rock that was the murder weapon, how did the serial killer respond to it? What clues did he give you that he was actually the killer?
Okay, what happened was, different from the prior interviews, they said he was very cocky, very assured of himself. He goes into the room, he sits down, he looks over, and he sees this rock. Right away, they can see his respiration increases. He's beginning to, his heart, they're looking at his artery, carotid artery in his throat. They could see it beating. They could see he's perspiring. He's crossing his arms, crossing his legs. And he's really getting tense from looking at this particular, it's the murder weapon.
And he can't take his eyes off of it?
Can't take his eyes off of it. And so so the other thing you have to do to get him to confess, because he killed a 14-year-old girl and he's 27, 28 at the time, is you have to provide a face-saving scenario. It's a horrible thing to do when you hear what you have to say, but what you have to say to get the confession is that the girl, in essence, she was the seducer, that she kind of put him up to this, but you, Mr. Killer, you've lost control. You lost control of the situation, and through fear, you killed her, almost like an accident type of thing. And so they did that. They took that advice, and lo and behold, he confesses to that particular rape murder, but also to a rape 3 years earlier in it was Rome, Georgia. So that was one of the first experiments that I did. And over the years, I've learned to try to find something at the crime scene, something that only the killer or whatever the crime may be would react to that particular stressor.
John Douglas is the former head of the FBI's Serial Crime Unit. His new memoir is called Mindhunter. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with John Douglas, the former head of the FBI's Serial Crime Unit. He retired from the FBI in June and now has a best-selling memoir called Mindhunter. He pioneered a type of criminal personality profiling based on what he's learned interviewing over 150 convicted killers. In his book, and in the first part of our interview, he explained some of the techniques he developed for tracking down serial killers and sex criminals. Are you giving away in your book, and of course in this interview, things that will help serial killers evade the cops?
No, that's a good question, because behavior reflects personality, I keep saying in that book. And I, myself, if I committed a crime, and I know all the tricks, I've taught the tricks, I would not be able to defend myself. If I was involved in a situation like that with The Rock, and they brought this in, or how about IRS, you know, brings you in, and if you fudged on your IRS record keeping, and they just bring this stuff in and place it off to the side, where you see this, the difference is that, and even these individuals, the psychopaths who have no conscience, everyone has a rock, and that's what we mean by that, is that you just have to find out what buttons you have to push and what the stressors are. But they can read this. I mean, they can read that, well, Douglas says that the killers go back to the gravesite, and I do go back to the graves. I want to go back there, so I'm not going to do that. Well, no, he's going to want to do that. He's going to be more careful. He's going to look around, and we have to be more careful as a law enforcement agencies, you know, and secrete ourselves better, hide better in that particular area so that the killer doesn't see us. But they'll go back. They always do.
Part of your technique is empathy, to put yourself in the shoes mm-hmm. of the victim and the killer. What kind of number does that play on you after you do that a whole lot?
Well, it wears you down, but to be good, that's why I was the main guy in doing this in the bureau and I guess anywhere in the country now, is that you have to be able to do that. To get in the shoes, you have to just have laughed with these guys, and I dress down when I do the interviews. If you would go by and see and hear me do the interview of a killer, you would probably have difficulty knowing who was the killer, because I do a pretty good job of it.
We might think it was you?
Yeah, well, you think it was me. We'd have a difficult time, because I would not be, you know, I'm not going to be that stiff. I'm going to be joking and laughing about the kills and this and that, but I'm looking for golden nuggets. I have to do this to get something that I can apply to an ongoing case. But then what's even more so is the victims, because I get very close to the families, and I empathize with the families and with the victim, and I try to imagine what the victim was hearing and was seeing and was feeling, that whole thing right up to her death. Because I have tapes of women and children who are in the process of dying, and there's this regression of calling back to their mommies, and I mean it's terrible. But it takes its toll, and it has taken the toll on the people who worked for me in my unit before I left, and many of them could only last three to five years. I stayed in this. I was doing that alone for nearly 20 years.
In 1983, when you were, I think it was 38, you got viral encephalitis, which raised your temperature about 107. You were in a coma. It came very close to killing you. When you were going into the coma, you imagined that all the killers who you had interviewed and helped track down over the years were taking the revenge on you and torturing you. Mm. It really made me think about what your own fantasy life must be like, having lived through hearing all these other really sick fantasies told to you.
Well, when you say my fantasy, what do you mean my fantasy?
Nightmares. I don't mean like the things that you wish you could do, but when your mind is left free at night and it just kind of roams around into the dark corners.
Well, it's gotten better, but nowadays and over the last say even 10 years, but at that particular time it was pretty bad. It was pretty hard on me, and I was working so many cases, 150 cases, and dealing with all these crazy people, and again, it was taking its toll on me, because I was, again, walking in the shoes and trying to help the victims, the families of the victims. So basically, what happened to me is I broke down. I broke down physically. I was probably jogging too much, drinking too much to cope with the stress of it. I was one-dimensional. I was only interested in work. Family was secondary. There was no religion, no socializing. So when I went out on the Green River murder case, I mean, I just broke down. So and had that high temperature you talked about and nearly died. I was paralyzed when I came out of a coma after a week. But while in that coma, I was aware of the pain that I was receiving, and that was them putting me on a life support system and putting tubes in every part of me. And I thought I was in hell. I really thought that all these crazies now were torturing me, and I'm going to die here. And it wasn't until a nurse began talking to me, that she didn't know I could hear her, that I just calmed down. She said, "John, you're very sick. You're in a hospital, and we're going to try to make you better." That I calmed down, but I'd be lying to you if I told you that it does not. I don't think about cases, or if I'm out with my children in a park, that I'm looking at an area in the park and say, gee, this looks like a place where I've had a case before where there's a disposal, someone disposed of a body. Or if I go out in a shopping mall with my two of my daughters, I'll point out potential people there that are up to no good. I'll point them out and say, "Hey, Lauren, take a look at that guy over there. See how he's looking at those children in that video arcade? He's looking at those children as if they're adult women. They're Raquel Welch." I said, "Let's just follow him, Lauren. Let's just see what he does." So I get my daughter, and we'll be following the guy, and the person will be following a child, almost like waiting for this opportunity. And I said, "Now this is not the kind of guy that's going to drag this child out of the store, Lauren. But this is the type of individual when you're out selling candy for your church or the Girl Scouts, and you knock on a door, and he just happens to be the living at that house, and he looks out, and I'm not with you as a parent, you're alone. You have now just crossed this path, and you can now become a victim of opportunity."
Did you worry about turning your daughter into somebody who was completely paranoid, who'd go into the playground and just scout out potential perverts?
I'd rather have her a little paranoid than to be so carefree and hitchhiking and trusting and naive. They have to know that there's some people out there, there's just some bad people that are going to hurt you.
I wonder if you give advice to people who don't want to become victims. You know, you'll hear one professional consultant will say, if someone ever says, get into my car or I'll kill you. Even if they say they're going to kill you, don't get into the car because they're bound to kill you if you do get into the car. Or someone will say, if someone points a gun on you, run or don't run. Are there any rules to follow, or do you think every criminal is different, every crime is different, and you've just got to do your best to assess the situation?
Right. Which is so different. You have to. Every crime is different. A woman, if it's a woman, has to, as a victim, a potential victim, has to make an assessment within seconds. If a scenario is, this would be a good scenario, particularly with the holidays, is the vehicle of choice today is a van. It's a construction type of van, which is insulated in the interior. It's like a room within a room. Inside you have flex cuffs and they have handcuffs, duct tape. And you are just shopping in a shopping center and you're walking out to your car. You don't have your keys ready. You're carrying bundles of gifts. You're thinking of tonight's dinner. And you didn't realize, first you're parked in way off in the parking lot. It's dark. And you didn't really notice this vehicle is very, very close, parked very close to you. The next thing you do or you find out is that as you enter your car, just before you enter your car, the side doors of the van opens up, you're whisked in there, and in a matter of seconds, you've been cuffed or duct taped and off you go. You have to fight. You have to fight like hell in as best as you can do in seconds. You're not going to be able to talk your way out of it. Just through deductive reasoning here, you're in his vehicle, so you're going to be able to identify the vehicle in the future. Plus, he probably doesn't have a disguise. You'll be able to pick him out in a lineup. So the chances are you're not only going to be abducted, you're going to be murdered. So that's one thing. But then if you're looking at, say, a rapist, there are six different rape typologies. And if if someone comes into your house, and you don't know which particular rapist that you're dealing with. Are you dealing with a sadistic rapist who borders on murder? Or are you dealing with what we call a power reassurance rapist who wants to make it pleasurable for you and he talks to you and he somewhat feels guilty afterwards? But I believe in these classes of defensive tactics. I mean, because if you're going to get away, you got to get away soon, right in the very, very beginning.
Well, I want to thank you so much.
Well, thank you
for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
John Douglas is the former head of the FBI's Serial Crime Unit. His new memoir is called Mindhunter. This is Fresh Air.